Could I welcome everyone here tonight and say how much pleasure it gives me to welcome Professor Ulrich Beck, colleague and friend. Ulrich Beck is perhaps the preeminent social thinker in Europe at the current time and has joined the school as British Journal of Sociology visiting centennial professor. He is presently Professor of Sociology at the University of Munich and was formerly professor at the University of Bamberg. Ulrich Beck's work has had enormous impact in the intellectual community on an international level. However, his thinking has also influenced more practical policy making in Germany and several other major European countries. Anyone who knows this work will know he frequently appears in the newspapers and is a prototype, I think, of a public intellectual in Germany. He's the author of several books, a large number of books and articles. His most influential book, many people here will know, Risk Society, was originally published in 1985 and was a bestseller in Germany. In that book, Professor Beck advanced a new theory of the changes now affecting the industrialized countries, using the theme of risk as a metaphor for wider problems and possibilities. His subsequent publications include The Normal Chaos of Love, A Study of Marriage, the Family and Personal Life, and Ecological Politics in an Age of Risk. His most recent work, in English anyway, is Democracy Without Enemies. Should point out there are plenty of seats available on the other side there if not enough room on the right. Ulrich Beck is currently a member of the Futures Commission, set up by the federal government of Germany, and since 1995, he has held a distinguished research professorship at the University of Wales in Cardiff. It is a great honor, and I might say personal pleasure, to have him with us this evening. The title of his lecture is Freedom's Children, Individualization in Late Modern Societies.
Thank you, Tony, for your kind introduction. It is indeed a pleasure and honor to speak to such a distinguished audience, such a distinguished place with such a distinguished director and being even a part of this whole distinguishedness. Really, I feel myself as a part of this cosmopolitan atmosphere you two only created in the last 14 months. I've been, I think, the first one to lecture under your, should I call it intellectual dictatorship or directorship? I'm, my English isn't as good, you know. Let me give you a general idea what my lecture is going to be about. We live in an age in which the social order of nation-state, class, the churches, the traditional family is in decline. The ethic of individual self-fulfillment and achievement is the most powerful current in modern society. This choosing, deciding, shaping individual who aspires to be the author of their life, the creator of their identity, is the central character of our time. In this lecture, I will argue that in contrast to the public criticism of the me first generation, this individualism is moral and political in a new sense. It is the fundamental change behind the changes in the family, in the global gender revolution, in the relationship to work and politics. In many ways, this is a more moral time than the 50s and the 60s. Freedom's children do feel more passionately and morally about a wider range of issues than they used to, from treatment to the environment and animals to gender, race, and human rights around the world. Of course, this transformation is highly ambivalent. It might give birth to the ugly citizen, too. But on the other hand, it could even become the basis of a world citizenship, which places globality at the heart of political imagination, action, and organization. To me, this is one of the most important implications. Any attempt to create a new sense of social cohesion has to start from the recognition that individualization, diversity, and skepticism are written into our culture. I will develop this argument in three steps. Firstly, what does individualization mean? It does not mean, and this is very important for a British audience, Thatcherism. It does not mean market individualism, not rational choice individualism, not atomization. On the opposite, it means institutionalized individualism. Most of the rights and entitlements to support by the welfare state, for example, are designed for individuals rather than for families or ethnical groups. In many cases, they presuppose employment. Employment in turn implies education, and both of these presuppose mobility. By all these requirements, individuals are invited to constitute themselves as individuals, to plan, understand, design themselves as individuals. Or should they fail, to blame themselves. Individualization thus is paradoxically a collective lifestyle, a collective code of Western societies. The normal biography thus becomes the elective biography, the reflexive biography, a risk biography. Everyday life is indeed becoming very complicated, threatened by breakdowns if, for example, only grandma doesn't take the children. Secondly, what does the new language of ethical globalization mean and imply? I'm convinced, as are David Held and Tony Giddens, that cosmopolitan democracy is a realistic utopian project. Thus, in an age of side effects, we have to reflect on the dark side of its much-wanted success in a very early stage. In which way can it be used politically as cosmopolitan facade, which fits nicely to old-style imperial adventures? Though there is an urgent need for open-minded self-critique of a Western global civil society imperialism. Third and finally, I will combine those two arguments on individualization and globalization and draw a few political implications. 150 years ago, Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto. Today it's time for a Weltbürger Manifest, a cosmopolitan manifesto. Let me start with the individualization thesis. Are we a me-first society? One might almost think so if one reviews the slogans which dominated the public debate. The dissolving of solidarity, the decline of values, the culture of narcissism, entitlement thinking, hedonism. Many ask, does a person who wants to live out his freedom ultimately only live out himself? Will modern societies fail from the atomization, the exhaustion of solidarity? The environmental movement, the environmental crisis comes to mind here. Modern societies live from natural resources that it has consumed and destroyed, but also from moral resources which is equally unable to renew. The value ecology, in which community, solidarity, justice, and ultimately democracy is rooted, is decaying. In contrast to that, the skeptic of democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, wrote as early as 1884, I quote, that fighting against freedom means fighting against God himself. What might that wanderer between the worlds of feudal and democratic ages have meant by this. A self-authorization of the individual was characteristic of European modernity from the very beginning. Its origin does not lie in capitalism, not even in humanism, and certainly not in the death of God, as Nietzsche said, but in the world of changing religious experiences of ancient Judaism and early Christianity, as well as in the discovery and release of the power of reason in Greek philosophy. A few chapters later, in Tocqueville's Democracy in America, one finds this sentence, which is hardly less shocking. The Americans battled individualism, the fruit of equality, with freedom, and they have succeeded it. Applied to the present debate, this implies that the symptoms of the me generation cannot be opposed with less freedom, they must be opposed with more freedom. But political freedom, freedom if sized and activated, filled out, fosters commitment in the public space and is thus the exact opposite of the neoliberal marked fundamentalism. This prescription opposing decline with public freedom is so important because it is in such dramatic opposition to the view almost dominant today that modernity needs, indeed uses up ties which it cannot itself renew. In this conception, modernity is inherently counterproductive. It permanently undermines the indispensable moral prerequisites. This self-concept of modern society, to me, is completely false. Christianity, for example, and political freedom are not mutually exclusive, but mutually inclusive, even if this builds an insuperable contradiction into the Christian traditions. The point is to give a simple, comprehensive answer to a complicated question. The question is, what is modernity? The answer is not just instrumental rationality, as Max Weber told us, not just market or capital, as Marx teaches us, or functional differentiation, as Talcott Parsons and Niklas Luhmann say. But supplementing and conflicting with these, it is political freedom, citizenship, and civil society. The point of that answer is that morality and justice are not extraterritorial variables for modern societies. Quite the reverse is true. Modernity has an independent, simultaneously ancient and post-postmodern wellspring of meaning in its midst, political freedom. The latter is not exhausted by daily use, instead it bubbles up with greater life. Modernity in this point of view means that a world of traditional certainty is perishing and being replaced, if we are fortunate, by legally sanctioned individualism to everyone. From here, two stages of modernity can be distinguished. In the first modernity, the issue of who has rights to freedom and who has not was largely answered and justified ontologically by recourse, for instance, to the nature of gender and ethnicity. Thus, for instance, with reference to their gender, motherhood, and to the voluntary nature of marriage, central civil rights such as the control of property, their own bodies, their own sexuality, were denied to women and transferred to their husbands until the beginning 70s, even in the Western countries. In the first modernity, thus, the contradiction that exists between universalistic claims and the particularistic reality of granted and denied rights to freedom are settled by the ontology of differences. By contrast, the panorama of a second modernity, which is now beginning to come into view, this ultimately essentialistically based architecture of given collective identities and life patterns with its clear definitions of in and out no longer applies, because the ontology of differences is worn out. The consequences are, first of all, a mess, an enjoyable or horrifying mess, sometimes both at the same time. In the context of sex relationship, this means a very normal chaos of love. Most of us are horrified enjoying. Men perhaps become new style fathers and yet remain more than ever men. Women struggle for professional recognition and ultimately rediscover the joys of motherhood as an alternative to career. Clever men pick up this and dramatize the emotional needs for motherhood in order to re-establish the old family order. In the struggle for the future of women, post-feminist and re-feminist women's group oppose each other and so on. In second modernity, therefore, the community group and identity structures is losing its ontological cement. Culture must be defined by liberty and thus by the absence of any principle of integration. It does not lead to a positive, essentialized definition of man, woman, Christianity, Islam, but rather to the individual's right to free himself or herself from all logics of power and domination. This is the source of political individualization. Movements often rainbow coalitions arise from this defend and enforcement on enforcement of one's own way of life. You could recognize this at the movement we watch in London at the weekend. I think this would be an example for this. We Western Europeans are not living in a crisis of culture and certainly not in a decline of values. Instead, we are threatened by something much worse. Our words of freedom are beginning to become deeds and thus challenging the basis of everyday life as well as our global politics. Being freedom's children means that we are living under the preconditions of radicalized democracy, radicalized modernity, for which many of the concepts and formulas of first modernity have become inadequate. No one knows how the ever-growing demand for the intimacy of the family can be connected to the new demands for freedom and self-realization for men, women, and children. No one knows how the needs of mass organizations, political parties and unions, to obligate the individual are compatible with the claims for self-participation and self-organization. People are better adapted to the future than our social institutions and their representatives. It is important to recognize that the secular change also creates the preconditions for mastering it, but preconditions, and of course only partly ones at that, not guarantee. The decline of values, which cultural pessimists are so fond of decrying, is in fact opening up the possibility of escaping from the creed of bigger, more, better in a period that is living beyond its means ecologically and economically. While in the old value system, the ego always had to be subordinated to patterns of the collective, these new orientations toward the we create something like a cooperative or altruistic individualism. An altruistic individualism, like Robert Wuthnoff is showing in his very interesting studies. Thinking of oneself and living for others at the same time, once considered as a contradiction in terms, is revealed as an internal connection. In fact, living alone means living socially. The German poet Hölderlin believed that danger is the mother of salvation. But none of us should be swept away by such sentiments, for freedom's children encounter a world in which prosperity, once considered certain, is eroding. The gap between the rich and the poor is widening up throughout the world. Even though some would like to deny it, it remains true that political freedom presupposes social security, as shown most impressively by Thomas Marshall in his famous study, Citizenship and Social Class. When security is lost, the sense of political freedom may easily become weak and fragile. I cannot explore into this in further details, even if it is terribly important. Instead, I want to summarize this individualization thesis by picking up the pressing question: how can a secular society exposed to the global market and based on an institutionalized individualism in the midst of the global communication explosion also foster a sense of belonging, trust, and cohesion? There have been discussed at least three fundamental questions, answers to this question in the history of social sciences. First, of course, by religion. Second, much debated, by violence, military, and war. Third, by participation in the labor market and wealth production. But our question today is, how will cohesion be possible in a world where the integrative mechanism of religion, war, and labor are diminishing? There is no easy answer to this question. If the argument stretched out here is made tenable, then there is a fourth mechanism, political freedom. It could be made into an internal, ancient, and yet highly modern source of cohesion, one which is not exhausted by daily use, but only flows stronger. But this is by no means an easy way to go. Helen Wilkinson and Guff Morgan, from which I have stolen the title Freedom Children, by the way, write, I quote, "Over half of under 25-year-olds register in Britain as profoundly disconnected from the system, and a growing number of underdogs are now prepared to bite back. We call them the underwolves." But still, modernity, having placed political freedom at the center, is therefore not an age of decline of values, but an age of values in which the hierarchical certainty of ontological differences is displaced by the creative uncertainty of freedom, including the dispute, what does freedom actually mean in the diversities of a world society? Now I come to my second argument on globalization. The most powerful answer to this question comes today from neoliberalism, which advocates, as you know, a replacement of state structure through market structure. There could be an easy solution to this problem. I recommend that confessing neoliberals set down by helicopter in the favelas, the ghettos of the outcast in South and North American cities. I'm sure he or she will, after at most a week, come back converted to the welfare state. What does the exclusion of ever broader parts of the world population, Asia's crony capitalism, and Europe's mad cow scare have in common? The answer is the failure to provide clear and enforceable rules governing market power and behavior. We are somehow beyond neoliberalism. The coming world trade conflicts will not be about deregulation, but about re-regulation in all areas, from telecommunication über food production to financial markets. Freedom Children has been said are the first to live in a post-national cosmopolitan world order. But what does this mean politically? Living in an age of side effects, we have to ask very early and very decisively, what are the unseen and unwanted consequences of the new rhetoric of a global community, global governance, and cosmopolitan democracy? What are the risks of the cosmopolitan mission? So let us have a quick glance on the brave new world of cosmopolitanism. A few years ago, the German defense minister said, after the end of the Cold War, Germany is suddenly surrounded by friends. The threat to be surrounded by friends defines the post-Cold War situation quite nicely. Not only for Germany, but for other Western and non-Western countries too. The East-West confrontation mobilized the military violence integration mechanism. It was an ideological cement for the high individualized societies in the West. Now the political institutions require a new legitimacy. The ethical language of globalization, at the very least, helps fill this gap through providing Western political institutions and politicians with a new set of cosmopolitan missions. We stand at the beginning of a democratic crusade, which sails under the flag of market ideology, human rights, and global neighborhood. The global age could be very easily a revamped global West, without an East to define itself against. Democracy without enemies, therefore, could mean democracy without the challenge of a basic criticism. Globalization implies denationalization, the weakening of the state structures, state autonomy, state power. State collapses have produced most of the really grave human conflicts of the 90s, whether in Somalia, West Africa, Yugoslavia, Albania, parts of the former Soviet Union, or maybe soon Indonesia in the new future too. So in areas of the world society where national government collapses or erodes, the global responsibility implies at least the possibility of Western military intervention. The more neoliberal politics on a global level succeeds, that is, state structures erode, the more likely a cosmopolitan facade arises which legitimizes Western military intervention and thus puts a permanent threat to ever larger parts of the population of the world society. Thus, the succeeding world free market ideology produces the paradoxes of what you could call global, civil, military, humanitarian threat. The striking feature of such old strategies, imperial adventures, is that such power games can coexist quite harmoniously with a cosmopolitan mission. Subordination of weak states to institutions of global governance does not seriously restrict, in fact, opens up the room for new power strategies under the facade of humanitarian intervention. So in a system of weak states, there could easily be an imperial misuse of the cosmopolitan mission. What exactly are those cosmopolitan values about when it comes down to earth? Sometimes I'm afraid of something which one might call the Switzerlandization of the world. That is a global Western middle class bias to moral politics. On one way or the other, there's a new cultural divide coming up between the champions of the new democratic global order in the West and the have-nots, the are-nots, the global others. The global community and its values are defined against these new global underdogs. Today, when the West is undergoing a crisis of political confidence, we find the global others portrayed in ways which reflect the unease of commentators in the West. The more sensitive commentators are to the democratic deficit at home, writes Chandler, the more negative is a prognosis for the new democracies of Eastern Europe. And of course, there are double standards of global morality too. Take the basic example of cosmopolitan democracy itself. David Held and his group is doing a wonderful job in developing ideas and models. But those are no reality and confronted with basic dilemmas. Let me pick up one of them by asking, what is going to happen if the European Union wants to become a member of the European Union? Of course, it would have to be refused. Why? Because of its glaring lack of democracy. But it must also be asked whether EU member states, such as France, Germany, Britain, Italy, can really be considered democracies when roughly half of the laws passed in their parliaments merely transplant guidelines issued by Brussels, the World Trade Organizations, and so on. So here's the democratic dilemma of the global age. While non-decisions increasingly find political legitimation within the democratically legitimate politics of the nation state, decisions of transnational scope and reach that have no democratic legitimation are taken within the transnational framework of non-politics. Roaming the new continent of the transnational are not only giant corporations, but also such diverse global players as supranational agency, Greenpeace, the churches, the European Union, non-governmental organizations. These are thought of as non-political, yet they act politically in a crucial new sense, for they play a major role in shaping the power relations, legal norms, lifestyles, forms of work and imagination of the global social landscape, and hence too of the national societies. Now I come to my last point, the prospect for a cosmopolitan manifesto. The Communist Manifesto has been published precisely 150 years ago. Today, at the beginning of a new millennium, it is time for a Weltbürger Manifest, as Kant might have called it, a cosmopolitan manifesto. In the age of global pop culture, let's start with a cartoon. It shows how the Spanish conquistadores, with their gleaming weapons, step into the new world. Their number one says, we have come to discuss with you questions about God, civilization, and truth. And a group of puzzled-looking natives reply, yes, of course, what do you want to know? Let's change the picture a bit. A group of global managers is stepping out of an intercontinental aircraft saying, we want to discuss with you questions about human rights, cosmopolitan democracy, and global neighborhood. And the locals reply, yes, what do you want to know? My definition of a global civil society is a world in which this is not a joke any longer. A world in which we have more than the two options, bloody global misunderstandings, without and with laughing about them. My idea, therefore, enforces a hidden meaning of the cartoon. The Western economic powers are condemned to be the listeners and learners in the global dialogue to come. So the open overall question is, how will democracy be possible in the global age, or what will it be like? Is there a political subject to raise this question? I believe it is. The much criticized Me First generation, Freedom's Children. As Ronald Engelhardt, in a recent study about cultural and political change in 43 societies, shows, there is a global erosion of nation-state authority and a declining confidence in hierarchical institutions in general, but at the same time a rise of unconventional citizen intervention, for example, in form of boycotts. This is true the more educated and the younger the population is. The space in which people think and act in a morally responsible manner are becoming, on the one hand, smaller and more intensive in behalf of personal relationships. And here the demands are increased to the point where they cannot be fulfilled. On the other hand, they are becoming global and thus, in the existing political form, difficult to manage. Young people are moved by that which national politics largely rules out. How can the global environmental destruction be resolved? How can one live and love with the threats of AIDS? What does tolerance and social justice mean in the global age? All these questions that slip through the screens of political agenda of nation states, all these slip through the screens of the political agenda of nation states. The consequences is that freedom's children practice a highly political disapproval of politics. But they have discovered something for themselves, something which make adults panic, fun. Fun sport, fun music, fun consumption, fun life. But politics, as it is currently practiced and represented, has nothing to do with fun. In fact, it acts like a killjoy. And hence, young people are unpolitical according to superficial impressions and in their own understanding, but in a very political way. Freedom's Children regroup in a powerful rebellion against obligations that are to be complied without reasons being given for them, and even if no one can identify with them. The key idea of a cosmopolitan manifesto is that there is a new dialectic of global and local questions which do not fit into the national politics. These local questions, as we might call them, are already part of the political agenda. But only in a transnational framework they can be properly posed, debated, and resolved. For this, there has to be a reinvention of politics, a founding and grounding of the new political subject that is cosmopolitan parties. These represent transnational interest transnationally, but also within the arenas of national politics. They thus become possible both programmatically and organizationally only in the plural, only as national global movements and cosmopolitan parties. Let me give you an example. In the last years, all sort of regulation-intensive industries are being liberalized. Telecommunication is the main example. Others include energy, financial and other services, and food. Increased competition in these areas have brought the domestic regimes that now regulate them into conflict. In the meantime, the problem has been global. And this is just the start. Looming ahead are new issues, environmental laws, labor regulations, and so on, in which regulation is even more sensitive. A first wave of national deregulation enforces a second wave of transnational re-regulation. This is a fundamental change, by which globality and the basic question, what does it really mean, is becoming a central problem not only in politics and transnational corporations, but in everyday life too. There are three options to handle the coming battle over re-regulation. First, cosmopolitan facade. The regulators are being turned into covert tools for national government intervention. Second, international regimes, establishing strong regulators who are independent of national politics. Third, cosmopolitan parties, which activate and open up the public for the new transnational agenda. Of course, those three options are not exclusive, but without a decisive step toward cosmopolitan democratization, we are heading for a post-political technocratic world society. The first expressions of a cosmopolitan politics are already taking shape within the framework of national states, expressions that require specific points to crystallize as political movements within and between national states. These create opportunities for cosmopolitan parties, which, even if they initially win over and mobilize only minorities for cosmopolitan issues, have the basis of their own power, have the basis of their power in the active opening out of the transnational domain. Of course, this is a very difficult task to achieve. Resolving problems in all these areas is already providing conflicts enough between the US and the EU. For example, over food safety questions, a source of bitter dispute. Difficulties will be even greater between countries where cultural assumptions, politics, and income levels diverge more. So cosmopolitan parties will have to organize the global disputes over these very controversial issues from within. What is crucial is that these issues should not only change color and weight, but also be posed differently according to whether they are located in the perceptual and axiological horizon of the nation states or the framework of transnational politics. So cosmopolitan movements form world parties in a threefold sense. First, their values and goals have not a national but a cosmopolitan foundation. Their appeal, liberty, diversity, toleration, is to human values and tradition in every culture and religion. And they feel an obligation toward the planet as a whole. National parties, on the other side, appeal to national values, traditions, and solidarities. Second, they are world parties because they place globality at the heart of political imagination, action, and organizations. Both programmatically and institutionally, they propose a politics of concrete alternatives to the firmly established and firmly guided priorities of the national sphere. Thus, for cosmopolitan parties, what is at issue is never just a certain content, but also a new concept, new structure, new institutions of politics, which for the first time offer a platform for the negotiation and enforcement of transnational issues from below. Third, they are world parties in the sense that they are possible only as multinational parties. Thus, there have to be cosmopolitan movements and parties of French, Canadian, North American, Polish, German, Japanese, Chinese, South African, and other provinces, which, by interaction with one another in the various areas of world society struggle to bring about cosmopolitan values. This involves strengthening of the existing independent transnational institutions and actors against national egoism, but above all else, it involves the democratization of transnational regimes and regulators. Who come into consideration as barriers of such cosmopolitan movement to expand democracy? Where are the voters who feel they are addressed and represented by cosmopolitan parties and could be mobilized and organized by them? I think where globality becomes an everyday problem or an object of cooperation, in the big cities, the globalities, the transnational organizations and movements and school and university, not at least like the LSC, the milieu and mentality of a self-conscious world citizenship take shape with post-national understanding of politics, responsibility, the state, justice, art, science, and public interchange. However, the extent to which this can already be seen as existing or is likely in the future is a long neglected question, which is still completely open both empirically and politically. Although this expanding world citizenship with national cultural rules should not be confused with the rise of a global manager class. A distinction must be drawn between global capitalists and global citizens. We can say, though, that a plural world citizenship is soaring with the wind of global capital at its back. For the bourgeois, must already learn to plan and act, must already learn to plan and take decisions in his own interest in a transnational framework, while the citizen must still think and act within the categories of the national state. Nevertheless, in the milieu of transnational structures, experts and counter-experts, transnational movements and networks, we can see experimental forms of organization and expression of a cosmopolitan common sense regarding globality. It is a mixture of skepticism about national egoism pretending to be universal necessities and skepticism which is provoked and made concrete perhaps precisely through initiation into the mistakes and defects of national bureaucracies. How can cosmopolitan parties become possible and powerful? In the end, this question can be answered only where people ask and listen to it in the space of political experimentation. Citizen of the world, unite. Thank you for listening.
We've got a bit of time for questions, and there is, a roving mic somewhere in the room back there. So, I don't know if anyone would like. There's someone posing a question.
Thanks. In your new society, don't you think there will be a sort of new friction between those who want to be free and those who don't want to be free? Don't you think freedom, in this sense, is an intellectually biased concept?
Does this work? Yes. For example, of course, you could ask if freedom is an intellectual biased concept. First of all, we might have to clarify what dimensions of freedom we have actually in mind. I'm not talking about philosophical freedom. I'm not talking about the freedom of will. I'm not talking about psychological freedom. I'm talking about political freedom, which means that individuals who do not have a collective identity or don't have a given collective identity have to combine their personal life situations with their situation on the market, for example. And political freedom implies that that you have to act and interact in public in order to construct your own biography and to construct your own social milieu and your political orientations and so on. In this meaning, if you have this meaning of political freedom, if you refer to this meaning of political freedom, it's first of all an empirical question because it is very much related to what I have been scratching as an individualization process. And I believe this process is dominant for our society, is an everyday process which everybody has experiences of and has to relate to. So for me, it is just not an intellectual concept, but a concept of how we have to act and react in a post-traditional society.
Hello, I wonder if I could ask, you just mentioned talking about constructing and reconstructing biographies, and I just wonder what happens, well, part, where do people get the skills for doing that, and what happens if they don't have those skills?
It is not very difficult to think about all those problems which evolve if you think of political freedom as one of the resources of boundings and meanings in modernity. I think it surely isn't an easy way of handling everyday and political problems. And you might have misunderstood me that I'm by myself all optimistic that this would happen. You know, I'm just opposing to a perspective which draws a picture in which modernity doesn't have any resources of meaning by its own, which is counterproductive in the sense that it abuses its own moral prerequisites. I'm working indeed on a book which I call The Ugly Citizen. And I believe in a situation where security is, social security is failing and liberties and freedoms are internalized, are basic assumptions of your own life situation, something like a violent and ugly citizen could occur. So freedom is not a one-way going to all the best of the world coming down on Earth right now. It is a very complicated way. But I wanted to point out that there is a resource inside a de-traditionalized, individualized society to which we could refer to.
One of the most alarming and unpredictable developments of the last few years, it seems to be, has been the growth in various parts of the world of conspiracy theory and the popularity of conspiracy theory, which, although these theories might not be held by very large numbers of people, have the potential to cause tremendous instability. Much of this anxiety is rooted in the existence of transnational organizations. And I'm wondering how this can be squared with your vision of cosmopolitan organizations?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm be able to solve all problems. And I am indeed, in the framework of theory I'm talking about, we are living in an age what I call reflexive modernization, which applies a vision of modernity where the foundations of the modern society are getting in question by the process of modernization itself. We are living in a society, in an age where basic questions about the foundations of our everyday life and our institutions are getting into question, and we have to debate about them. There are two reactions possible. The one reaction is a fundamentalism, which tries to answer those questions with old theories and assumptions. And I think this is a very strong movement in modern society, which picks up modern elements, modern strategies. And I think this, what you have in mind, conspiracy theory, is one which fits into this movement very nicely. And I think this is, I would agree with you that that this is part of a counter-modern movement, which is opposed to all the insecurities and uncertainties which come up in a global cosmopolitan world order. I do agree with you in this interpretation, but as I said, I don't have a solution for this problem.
You mentioned that the governments of the West will now have to sit back and listen through your cartoon analogy. But don't you also think that there's a problem in the inequalities, not only of poverty, but in the rate of individualization and the receipt of freedom? And doesn't this affect the voices that are there in the room to be listened to?
Yes, I believe there is. I think there's quite... Individualization doesn't mean that everybody is in the same situation. There's a deep relationship, an intensive relationship between individualization and growing uncertainties and growing inequalities. Even if we are getting more individualized, we are getting perhaps more radicalized, unequal. And because individualization often does have quite a few, an individualized society does have a lot of problems in organizing interest groups. So there's quite a lot of differences in an individualized world. And if you look at the dialogue I was pointing at, even the individualization process itself is, of course, a Western concept, which is debated and questioned in other countries. And there's no absolute priority for individualization on a world scale, on a world scale. So, of course, there are very many different voices, but to me, I think it is quite important to recognize that one of the value positions I myself engaged in this cosmopolitan democracy or this global civil society could be misused in an ideological sense as a new Western, a new way of Western imperialism or a new way of ideology of the Western goodness, which is going to be coming over the world. I think this is an important self-criticism in order to open up the debate about what cosmopolitan democracy on a really transnational level should mean in future.
Yeah. Yes, your concept of political freedom.
speak up a bit, though.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, it's okay. I can hear.
Your concept of political freedom requires citizens with the skills to understand increasingly complex causal networks associated with relevant problems in the global society. I think that the group of people who has known these skills probably will choose other behaviors and not related to this new citizenry. So how can we deal with this? We will always have this. My question is that I think that this is a role for elites that is very difficult to disseminate at a massive level. This global citizen.
To take your question seriously, I believe indeed that there are going to be social differences in behalf of the global citizenship. It requires higher education, and it requires maybe a sort of social security, which isn't a prerequisite which everybody in every country has. And there's a second question to me you seem to ask. What do we do with those who are against this form? Not only which we do with the others, but what do we do with those who are opposed to this form of global citizenship? And indeed, this is a very basic question, but this is a question which democracy always has to answer. What do you do with those who do have a different and opposing option and opinion? And I do believe that there, at least in the process of individualization, we find a lot of orientations and abilities to handle with those questions in a more open-minded way than it has been in the past.
Before you talk, you mentioned Max Weber, a German sociologist who also lived in Munich. I was wondering, Max Weber seems to be having a bit of a comeback now. How much is modern sociology, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and your personal theories influenced by his thinking?
You wouldn't find a German sociologist who is giving a lecture in a different country, even if he gives a lecture in Germany, who wouldn't quote Max Weber. Max Weber is the Pope of sociology, and everybody can find very influential arguments with Max Weber. But still, if you listen carefully, or if you try to find out what my position is, I think that, for example, Max Weber emphasize too much what I would call the linear theory of rationalization, a rationalization process which is going on whatsoever, a bureaucracy of bureaucracy is going on whatsoever. And I'm trying to point out that what I call a reflexive modernization, or if you want to say a reflexive rationalization, which means we are confronted with side effects which open up the cage of modernity. Weber is scratching us. So we all are somehow bound to the Pope, especially if you live in Munich, very close to where he had lived. But I think there's a necessity to think basic questions in a new way, and this is actually what reflexive modernization theory is about.
Professor Beck, could you please explain how your concepts of cosmopolitan politics differ from the communist and the labor internationalism that existed at the beginning of the century? Thanks.
Well,
my reference to the communist manifesto was ironical. I hope you know, when Germans talk, you sometimes don't get the idea that they could be ironical. but this was supposed to be ironical. I think this is the only way to pick up the parallel between those two concepts. I think it's a complete difference of concepts, because I was pointing at the necessity or the possibility of founding cosmopolitan parties. This is something completely different. Cosmopolitan parties in the sense that they are national parties and transnational parties at the same time, because they pick up transnational affairs, cosmopolitan affairs in national context, and this way becoming a subject of a transnational politics. It is a politics which to me is not related to the idea of critique of capitalism as the communist manifest tried to do it, because I'm building a theory which tries to make a distinction between what I call first modernity and second modernity. And one of those aspects of the second modernity is that the conflict of capital and labor isn't a central conflict anymore, just because we are a society where labor plays an ever smaller part. So it is a quite different conceptualization of the modernity we're heading in. But I think it's important to think about the possibilities of founding cosmopolitan national parties to pick up those transnational agendas which we are heading at, wherefore we don't have a political voice and not a political organization so far. Simple answer, yes.
But I mean, in what ways? I mean, partially because of the problem that these NGOs are non-democratic. What problems do you see in the instigation of that?
No, I think they are movements, cosmopolitan movements, which could be the basis for cosmopolitan parties. But cosmopolitan parties would be something different. They would have been founded in the party system, in the national party system, and they would have elections for them and anything else, like normal national parties too, which hasn't been so by the non-governmental organizations so far.
I think actually, although there are other questions, I'm plainly pressing, we ought to finish, and I'd just like to thank Ulrich Beck again for coming here tonight, for his presentation, for being associated with the LSE. Thanks very much.